Technorama, interview with Ernest Cline.
Good morning, folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Hey, I'm looking for that Easter egg in that one video game. You know, that one.
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts to disregard all safety rules. Here, your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. If you're a returning listener, welcome back. If you're a new listener, we appreciate you giving us your time. I am your host, Chuck Tomasi, and with me is our esteemed co-host. You've been esteemed. Did you know that? Craig Stepp. How are you, Craig?
Just be sure to take me out of the teapot before it's too... steeping. Sorry.
That's steeping. Esteemed is like vegetables.
Greg Steepy.
With the new the new bamboo esteemer.
Steamer. No, I'm doing good, man. I'm super excited to be talking to Ernie today.
Yeah, with us today, we have a very special guest. See, I listened to the audiobook Ready Player One about a year ago, and Craig just finished reading the book and said, we've got to talk to this man.
Yeah, it took me a year to read it. No, it didn't.
It took me like two weekends to listen to it.
Yeah.
So it's our honor to welcome author Ernie Cline. Welcome to the show, Ernie.
Well, thanks for inviting me to do your podcast.
Very welcome. Thank you for joining us. Welcome to the show.
All right, cool.
Hey, well, by the way, I'm from Texas as well. So I was like, wow, another nerd from Texas.
Oh, yeah. Well, you're from Texas, but you're in South Carolina?
Yeah, I was born here, and we lived in Texas through the 70s, pretty much. I lived in Spring, Texas.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, you got like kind of a twang, but I thought it was a South Carolina twang, but now I know it's a mixture.
It's a mix, yes.
Right on.
Yeah, my grandmother said, you don't sound like you're from here, you know. Well, sorry.
Sorry.
Yeah, and Ernie, you don't sound like you're from Texas, so tell us a little bit about yourself.
I'm from Ohio. I grew up in, that's why I like a big chunk of my book and my movie Fanboys are set in Ohio. I grew up in a small town called Ashland, which is like north of Columbus, south of Cleveland. It's like a little like 25,000 people, small town, and you know, rest stop off the highway. And that's where I grew up and spent the 70s and 80s. And then I moved around the country a lot, and then eventually made my way to down here to Austin because I'd never lived in the South, and I was really interested in independent filmmaking and Austin. Just everything I heard about it, it was just an awesome town, and I ended up moving here around 1996, and it has since become just my favorite city, and I never want to leave. It's a great town to be a movie geek and everything else. If you're into music or movies or art or whatever, it's a really awesome town, and it's not anything like the rest of Texas. It's like an island of awesomeness, you know, it's surrounded by, you know, Texas.
Awesome Texas. I mean, yes. Austin, Texas. Awesome,
yes.
Austin.
Yes. So, yeah. So, I've been living here since about 1996, and I had to move away a few times, but have always come back, and hopefully this time I'm here to stay.
Well, you've done a lot of things, but probably the one you're most recently noted for is a book called Ready Player One. Tell us about the book.
Oh, are we already recording the show? Are we already making this happen?
Oh, heck yeah. Yeah, okay. Whatever.
Awesome.
First rule of podcasting, start recording off the bat. So we just kind of jumped in.
See, that's awesome. See, other times I've called into podcasts and I'll like be talking and think that we've already started the show. And they're like, all right, now we're going to start. And I'm like, we've been talking for like an hour. So that's awesome.
This isn't our first radio.
Oh, right on. Ready Player One, is my first novel that I spent many years writing. I kind of had the idea for it almost 10 years ago and wasn't sure at first if it was going to be a screenplay or what, but I had this idea of what if Willy Wonka had been a video game designer instead of a candy maker and held his, you know, golden ticket type contest inside his greatest video game creation. That was the first idea that I had. And I grew up, you know, kind of obsessed with video games and loving my Atari 2600 that I was kind of spot welded to through my entire childhood. And I was really inspired by the Sword Quest games that Atari put out, which was like a series of puzzle games that also tied into this contest that Atari was running, where if you were like one of the first kids to solve these elaborate puzzles within the Sword Quest games, then you could be entered to win a much larger prize. Like they gave away like a jeweled crown and like a jeweled scepter and these things that were worth like $25,000. So it was like that really set my imagination on fire when I was a kid, this mm-hmm. idea of video game contests. And also Warren Robinette, who is a video game designer at Atari, who put the very first video game Easter egg in his game Adventure, which is one of my first and favorite Atari games.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and that just when I found that when I was a kid, it blew my mind because it was like a direct connection between me and the video game designer. This like secret that he had left inside the game, you know, for me to find, and that was really powerful. So those the Sword Quest games and Adventure, and also like Activision used to have this promotion where if you were it took a photo of your high score on yeah. the screen, yeah, you could mail it in, and they would send you like a cool a cool patch to prove what a that you could put on your jacket to prove what a video game. Badass.
I think I mailed one in myself.
Yeah, yeah. I wish I had mine now, but I don't. I'm gonna have to buy those off of eBay. But
yeah.
But all of that. So all of that, like, kind of fed into this idea that I had about this eccentric video game designer who would, you know, be kind of a mashup of Richard Garriott, like Lord British, and Howard Hughes, and that. And they created like the greatest video game in history, and then had his contest inside it. So then I started to imagine what, you know, what the greatest video game in history would be. And it seemed to me that it would be, you know, like the future. What could the coolest future video game be? And how would that merge with the internet and social networking and all of that? And that was how I came up with the idea for the Oasis, which is this sprawling virtual world that James Halliday, the eccentric billionaire, creates. And I spent a lot of my 20s working in computers, working in IT and doing web design and tech support. So I was mm-hmm. I spent all day every day on the internet, kind of ignoring
my job.
You have
our sympathies.
Yeah, yeah.
We've been there.
Yeah, but
we
I
are
you know,
there.
Yeah, but I'm but I you know that was awesome for me because that was the job. That was really the only job that I was suited for. Like any job where I could just browse pop culture websites, you know, and help people with their computers. I like helping people with their computers because computers is something I've always been interested in, and mm-hmm. and it's an excuse to keep up on current computer technology. And through the 90s, like my first job doing that was at CompuServe, which I remember being fascinated by CompuServe when I was a kid. It was like one of yeah. the first dial-up services, and they're centered in Columbus, Ohio. So that was my first big job working in a cubicle farm for a corporation. In Columbus, Ohio, was CompuServe, which is kind of and I was surrounded – all my friends worked at other corporations like Nationwide and things like that in Columbus. So that heavily informed my novel Ready Player One. That's why the evil corporation is in Columbus, Ohio, and why, you know, Wade ends up working tech support and having – you know, being an indentured servant and having to pay off his debt. Like all of that is was kind of my experience in my 20s of working for a corporation and trying to pay off my credit cards.
It does make a lot of sense.
Yeah. I feel like I couldn't quit my job and I'm stuck here, yeah. you know. And so all of that. They say that when you write your first novel, you kind of like reveal everything about yourself. And that's what I did. I just kind of threw my whole life in. And the big kind of breakthrough for me was when I started to think about the riddles and puzzles and clues that this eccentric billionaire would leave behind to choose a worthy successor. Like what were the challenges and the knowledge mm-hmm. that he would set up would require? And then I realized, well, you know, if this guy's a computer geek and a video game designer, then he's probably going to be into a lot of the same stuff that I am, comic books and science fiction movies and Dungeons and Dragons and, you know, classic video games and mm-hmm. and all of that. And so I realized all the riddles and puzzles and clues and challenges could deal with that stuff that I'm obsessed with. And then I wouldn't have to do any research. And B, I would be writing about every time I would sit down to write, I would be writing about stuff that I loved and stuff that had been a part of my life. And it would be a way for me to weave that into the story and maintain my own interest in the story while I was writing it. And it's also like something that there's like a shorthand that you use when you talk to your friends. Like if your friends are into the same stuff that you are, then you guys will, you know, you'll end up quoting a movie, some obscure line from a movie or referencing a video game. And, you know, and if your friend gets it, then that like is a shorthand between the two of you. It like it's like a abbreviated language that you use. And I wanted to try to write a novel in that shorthand language that I use when mm-hmm. I'm with my friends and that I know everybody uses with their friends.
Oh, yeah.
And, yeah. And so that's what I tried to do by, you know, using Wade's voice and having him be obsessed with and interested in all this stuff because he's trying to solve Halliday's puzzle, puzzles and clues. He needs to immerse himself in all this 80s pop culture, which that idea struck me as funny, as like kids studying the stuff from my childhood. Yeah. As, you know, and it finally gives it importance. All this useless knowledge in my brain, I've created a scenario where it's, you know, allows you to save the world. All this Monty Python dialogue and, you know, Pac-Man patterns and all of that. So it was just a really fun idea. And the whole time I was writing it, I wasn't sure if you could even write a novel like this and get it published, because it seemed like I was, you know, just stealing from everything pop culture. But it turned out that it's all fictitious use. And the other thing is, I just wasn't sure it would appeal to anybody but me, because I was basically writing about my own childhood and my own pop culture touchstones and the things that had been important to me. Until I wrote this book, I had no idea how much that would translate to everyone else. But I've
you
since
struck
discovered,
a nerve.
Yeah, that's the thing. I've since discovered that, you know, my childhood in Ashland, Ohio in the 70s and 80s wasn't that different from anybody else's childhood who grew
that's
up
right.
in those decades. And I think it's because part of the American, you know, monoculture that we had by then, even regardless of what part of the country you grew up in, Texas or Michigan or Ohio or California or, you know, Seattle, like we all had the same video games at our local arcade. We had the same TV shows and cartoons on our television and the same big blockbuster movies. You know, Ghostbusters was playing at our local theater, and we had the same textbooks at our school. Like so much of America, you know, regardless of where you live geographically, you had all this common stuff. And by me referencing that, like, it allowed me to speak in like a shorthand, a cultural shorthand with the reader. And so that was one of the biggest surprises with me. I'd had like a little dose of that with my movie Fanboys, which was all about being a Star Wars fan or growing up being obsessed with movies. But I know that Star Wars is something, you know, pervasive and that meant a lot to everybody, because I wrote it right in the lead up to episode one. I wrote it, the movie, when it was set in 1998, right in the height of prequel mania, when everybody was freaking out about the first new Star Wars movie in 15 years. And and I remember, you know, having the, you know, my mother had died a few years before that. And I remember I was still kind of thinking morbidly because of that. I remember having this thought, what if I knew I was going to die and I wouldn't live to see this movie that I've been waiting my entire adult life to see. And my first thought was, well, that's a really ridiculous thought, you know, that's a really ridiculous idea that you would want to stay alive so you can see this science fiction movie. But also, it was like a genuine fear that I suddenly had. I'm like, oh, that would be horrible if I missed this thing I've been waiting for 15 years since I was
geek.
Yeah, since I was, because that was 1983 when Return of the Jedi came out, and I was like 11 years old. And then in 1999, I was 27. So from the time I was 11 until I was 27, I had been waiting to see this movie. And that was, you know, that was my whole adult life up to that point. And I remember talking about this idea with a couple of friends of mine who were also huge Star Wars fans and were dying to see this movie. And they said, dude, don't even joke about that. And one friend of mine is like, dude, I know exactly what you mean. He's like, I'm more careful now when I drive on the highway, especially around big trucks. I don't want to get in an accident.
I get $5 extra at church.
Yeah. And I'm like, really? Like, so it's like an actual genuine fear. I'm not the only one who has this weird thought that this movie means so much to them. And so that as soon as, you know, I'm like, well, what would I do if I knew I wasn't going to live to see this movie? And then my first thought was I would have to get my friends together and drive across the country and try to break into Skywalker Ranch out in San Francisco and try to see it early. And then I'm like, that would be a great idea for a movie. So that was the idea for that. And that was all about, you know, kind of the way that pop culture binds you together with your friends, and the way that a shared love of some facet of pop culture can really unite you with your friends and be like the thread that, you know, carries your friendship along through everything else. And so that's always been like a theme in my writing, and it's been, you know, a huge factor in my friendships with my friends. Like the people that I'm drawn to are people that are, you know, into, as passionate about the things that I am, movies and video games, that, you know, that that everyone is. So so that same kind of thing fed into Ready Player One, but Ready Player One felt like it was a lot more personal, a lot more specific to me, like the specific crap that I was really into, like Ultraman and, you know, giant robots and Zork and like the specific stuff. And so I wasn't sure how that would translate, but it turned out, man, like, yeah, the, you know, the stuff that I was into is stuff I was not as special as I thought. And the stuff that, you know, and I have, you know, I have people, men and women.
No, it's special. But yeah, You don't think it's that unique?
Yeah, but I mean, but I have people come up to me and like, dude, I could swear when I was reading this book, it just freaked me out because you were mentioning all this stuff that I thought was just specific to me. Is like you, it's like you snuck into my head when I was asleep and, you know,
stole my memories
and wrote this book, which is, you know, really flattering and awesome. And also like a really like powerful thing to discover is that you have all these things in common with people that you don't know and have never met. And it's been the, like the coolest thing about writing this book and then going out on my book tour and getting to, you know, meet people that also connected with it. It's like, you know, everything that you would want to happen when you write a novel, has happened to me with this book. And so, I'm nervous about writing this. I'm starting work on the next one and I'm just assuming there's no way. I joke that I'm going to call it Sophomore Slump, just as the title, you know, just so people know.
I figured it was going to be Ready Player Two.
Yeah. That, you know, I did register ReadyPlayer2.com and ReadyPlayer3.com. Yeah.
Well, see, I figured the third one would be called Game Over.
Yeah. Well, I registered those websites because I didn't want them to turn into porn websites.
Continue playing?
Yes. But Ready Player One was like one of my favorite games. Like a lot of games would say Get Ready Player One or just say Player One.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite games of all time, which is actually sitting here in this room with me, is Black Tiger, which plays a big role in my book. And Black Tiger was one of the games that would say that exact phrase every time you would put in a quarter, even if you weren't playing with someone else, if you're just playing a one-player game, every time you would start a new life, it would say Ready Player One. And I always that phrase always stuck with me, and it always seemed like it would be a great title. And then once I started working on this idea, I'm like, oh, that would be the perfect title for this book. But Ready Player Two, you know, also, you know, I hate to disavow that title because it seems like a good that might be like part of the title. It might be Ready Player Two, and then followed by something else. I don't know, but I continue.
Is the second book going to be in the same universe?
Yeah, well, you know, I initially just wanted to write a standalone story that ended at the end of the book. I like it when you read a book and a book ends and you don't have to wait 2 years for another book.
And that's the feeling I got at the end of this. I was like, okay, cool. Yeah.
But I mean, like anybody who reads the book, I spent a lot of time wondering what would happen to the characters after the story ends. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, I ended up kind of outlining what two more movies in the series of books might be. So, but that's not what I'm writing next. I'm writing a completely different novel that's not set in the same world and doesn't deal with the same characters or anything. But I haven't ruled. Everybody asked me about Ready Player One sequels, and I think that I will definitely, you know, get around to writing them someday. Just because that universe and the universe of the Oasis is so much fun because it mashes up all of pop culture together into one giant, you know, storytelling sandbox where anything can happen, where you can have Mechagodzilla fighting Ultraman, fighting Voltron with X-Wing fighters.
Yeah, I was geeking out when you started pulling them out.
Yeah, but I mean, it's just, you know, it's like what you used to do with a kid when you have all your different action figures fighting each other, G.I. Joe versus Luke Skywalker, and, you know, and doing that in a virtual world, I mean, that's kind of what the internet is now. When you go out on the internet, you're surrounded by all of the different pop culture that you love because everybody is devoted, everything that you might be into or obsessed with or used to be obsessed with, there is a website devoted to it where somebody, whoever the biggest fan of it, has created, you know, an ultimate catalog of every Transformer, you know, or every GoBot or G.I. Joe or every Star Wars character. All of that is available online. And it seems to me like once the internet evolves into a virtual space, then, you know, those, you know, all of that will end up being recreated virtually, which will be amazing. You know, like when I write anything, it's just me imagining, you know, wouldn't this be cool? Wouldn't this be cool if this happened? which is, you know, and by some miracle, like I managed to figure out a way to make a living at that by just saying, wouldn't this be cool if this happened? And then, you know, writing about it. So I'm rambling, guys. You gotta hit me with some questions.
All right. So yeah, no kidding. Well, okay. So I know you got all this stuff rolling around in your head and you were mentioning about Sword Quest and all that. And as a matter of fact, I've got an Atari Age magazine behind me.
Oh, right on.
So when you started bringing that up, I thought, oh man, I totally forgot about that contest. And, you know, and it came back and I remembered about all the four different games. And so my question was, did you have to do any research, or what kind of research did you do to kind of dig up all this stuff?
Well, yeah, all the stuff that's mentioned in the book, the pop culture stuff, like, is stuff that I remembered, or stuff that I was, you know, passionate about, or stuff that was still in my head. And and sometimes, like, when I would write about it, I would pull, because I had the internet right there, so I would pull it up and look at a photo of the video game cover, or play, you know, pull up a YouTube video of the music video that I was, you know, thinking about, just to refresh my memory, because it was all right there at my fingertips. But like, the idea to include it, the initial idea to include it was always just from my memory. Like, I never looked at like a list of things from the 80s and tried to figure out a way to squeeze it in. It was all just kind of flowed naturally, the way in a conversation you will reference Ghostbusters or reference Back to the Future, or, you know, make an Aliens reference, like, just as a, just because it pops into your mind because of the circumstance. Like, that's what I tried to do in the story. Like, you know, if like in the end battle, you know, when they're trying to get the force field around the castle.
Spoiler alert.
Yeah, I know. Spoiler alert. So, like, but I mean, it occurred to me, I'm like, oh, you know, like, one of them should make a Return of the Jedi reference, because they try to get the shield down in Return of the Jedi, and it's kind of the same thing. And that's what I do, you know, throughout my life. You know, whenever you're in a moment that reminds you of something from a movie or a song, you will reference that. And then, it, you know, it's funny because it, you know, other people know exactly what you're talking about, even without you having to explain it. And it, you know, or sometimes you do, are with people that you have to explain it to, and they don't get it. And, you know, and so that's what I try to do in book, is just throw those things out and explain them when they were necessary to understand the plot and what was going on. And when it wasn't, just let it, you know, sit there. And if somebody wanted to, you know, look up the reference, they could. And that's the other weird thing that I discovered going out on my book tour, is that, like, kids really love this book. Teenagers who weren't even alive in the 80s, you know, dig this book, just because they have grown up without, you know, without ever knowing a time without the internet.
Great. Here come the parachute pants and...
yeah, you know, but any of that, they like, anything they didn't understand, they would, like, kids read the book with Wikipedia open or with YouTube open and or Google, and they just Google something they don't get, and then immediately they have an image of it, or a video of it, or, you know, or they can play the Flash version of Pac-Man, you know, immediately, and know exactly what I'm talking about.
Hey, by the way, for what it's worth, anytime you mentioned a song in the book, I played it.
Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. One of the first things I did when I, after the book was published, was make a playlist and post it on my blog of, like, all the songs mentioned. So anytime a song is mentioned, you could just, there's a link to it on my blog, on my website. You just click on it, and, like, I made a YouTube playlist and Spotify and iTunes. And so,
And I started going, man, I hadn't listened to Rush in a long time.
Yeah. See, I never stopped listening to Rush. That was my band. They play a big role in Fanboy. There's like a couple Rush songs on the Fanboy soundtrack too, because that was my band in high school. And I don't listen to them as much as I used to, but in high school, that was like the only band, you know, that
was
the
band. I love Rush. They're awesome.
Yeah. And so, the real research that I did for the book had to do with virtual reality technology, and the way that the U.S. military is driving virtual reality technology by creating, you know, omnidirectional treadmills and virtual reality goggles, like, all of that. Is so that they can train soldiers in a consequence-free environment to understand what it's like to be in combat with actually putting them in combat. And so I did a lot of research about that, and how, and also the way that video games kind of drive computers to get better. The big reason for computers to get better and better is so they can, you know, render games more clearly. And the thing, you know, like, computers haven't needed to get better for word processing or web browsing.
Oh, and I thought porn was the driving force in technology.
Yeah, well, that too, yeah.
Well, that's internet bandwidth, sorry.
Well, that too, you know. I heard William Gibson talk about that. He said, like, the driving force for any kind of, like, entertainment technology, starting with photographs, has been, like, a big driving force has been pornography. Like, the very first photographs, like, one of the first uses for that was, like porn photos for Civil War soldiers to carry around with them, you know, because they had to be away from their ladies. So that was, like, one of the things that spread it. Photography is, like, so, you know, widespread. And the same thing happened with the internet almost immediately. It became, you know, and, you know, phones, like, as soon as we had phones, people reinvented phone sex lines. And as soon as we had the internet, you know, porn websites and chat rooms, all of that. It's human nature. Humans are going to use whatever their technology is, you know, to do what
haptic suits.
Yes, to do what humans do. That's why I didn't shy away from that. I'm like, you know, if the Oasis is going to be as badass as, you know, as the ultimate video game, and in the future internet, there's going to be porn. It's going to be used for porn, and you know, and that's something already people are trying to figure out ways to use the existing internet technology to, you know, to do that. And I remember seeing like the first Real Doll, the ad for the Real Doll, which is basically just like a, you know, an animatronic sex doll that doesn't have, you know, robotics in it yet. But there was this great movie in the 80s about called Cherry 2000. You guys ever see Cherry 2000?
It rings
I remember
bell.
Hearing about it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not a good movie, but it, this guy's sex robot breaks down, and then it's missing a part, so he has to go out into like the wasteland, into this badland.
It's a Skywalker Ranch. Let's go.
yeah, exactly. He has to go on this mission with Melanie, and he hires like a bounty hunter who ends up being a hot chick, Melanie Griffith, to help him find the part for his sex robot. I don't know. I digress. Anyway.
But you mentioned the Oasis. The Oasis is such a rich environment. And the real world in the book is so, you know, desolate, beat up, and depressed. Why the juxtaposition there, Ernie?
Well, that was part of the reason. Like, I wanted it to be believable that that people in the future would spend a big chunk of their lives inside a virtual world, and so I wanted to make the virtual world sound as appealing and immersive as possible, as close to real life as possible, which is, you know, video games are already getting that way. Like, mm-hmm. I know when I go into Best Buy sometimes and I think like all the TVs are playing a football game, but they're not. They're actually playing like an Xbox mm-hmm. football game that looks exactly like real football sports coverage. I mean, it's already, video games are already getting like hyper realistic. That was one element of it. And also, research about the future. It's and I also wrote the book, you know, between 2001 and 2010, when you know climate change and peak oil and you know global terrorism and all those things were kind of on everybody's mind, and it seemed like things were just getting worse every year, the economy [S2] Right. [S1] and everything. And so, trying to imagine the world 30 years from now, with all of that, you know, progressing, you know, decades into the future, it led me to believe that the real world might be that way. I, you know, people ask me like, is that what you think the future is going to be like? And my answer is, I hope not. You know, because I have a daughter.
There's Nostradamus, then there's Ernie Klein.
Right.
We'll find out after the next election.
Yeah. You know, well, you never know how things are going to develop. And the thing that I'm not willing to rule out is human ingenuity. You can never rule out human, no matter how bad things look, you know, like with the energy crisis or peak oil or climate change, like human beings, that's when our human beings really shine. That's when we always invent something that bails us out, you know, and necessity is the mother of invention. So when the worst things get, the more likely it seems that, we'll invent things or figure out, humans will find a way. And we, you know, throughout all of this, we're doing amazing things with biotechnology and bioengineering and, you know, solar energy and all of that. It seems like there could be a much brighter future than the one depicted in my book, but it also seems like it could go the other way too. And we could be, you know, Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, as well. So, but for the purposes of my book, it served the story well to have the real world be crappy. And I had a lot of visual ideas, you know, like the stacks, kind of these,
that was interesting to me. I thought that was cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that was just came from me imagining, you know, I know my way around a double wide trailer, fellas. I spent some time in trailer parks growing up. And so so me imagining like what could be worse than a trailer park? How about a vertically stacked trailer park? you know, where the trailers are stacked on top of each other, you know, just poverty upon poverty.
Hey, I have lived in a house that had a half address, which was in the backyard of another house.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Similar.
Yeah. See, I've lived in trailers that have had extensions built onto them, where it started out as a trailer, and then they built, you know, a house onto it to create more room. I had an uncle who put two trailers, like, facing each other to create, you know, like a one big... Yeah, no, like side by side.
Oh, side by side.
A double wide trailer. And then he connected them.
Like, how much land did he have? He just stretched them long.
Yeah, I think he just drug them out in the woods, you know, and squatted into his two trailers. I don't know. But all of that was, you know, and also there are these places in Brazil and other places like in Hong Kong where people would do that. These things called favelas in Brazil, where they just using whatever materials they have, they would build kind of these shanty towns on top of each other, where they're just places are stacked 4 and 5 high. And they would collapse all the time. And so, like everything in the book that I tried to imagine in the future, I tried to do what good science fiction writers do and base it on real stuff and try to make it believable and that it could happen. I would be nice if the video games are that awesome, but I would like for the real world to, be livable and pleasant as well. But I do think that is where the internet is headed. It seems like every year video games get more advanced and the way, and the internet gets faster and our computers get, better. And we already all of us carry around, a portable handheld computer that connects us to a global information network at all time and with global positioning satellites and, constant access to the entire library of human music and art and movies. And it's crazy the technology that you already have, and it's 2012. So imagining what it's going to be like in 2042 is a tall order. But my prediction is that video games are going to be awesome. Awesome. Then
you mentioned that shorthand notation where you just like say phrases and things to your friends. You want to have even more fun? Try it on strangers.
Right. Oh yeah.
I was in London in mid September and conducting a 2-day workshop for one of our customers. We had a guy from the U.S. We had a couple from London. We had one from Ireland. We had one from I don't know where. So about 5 or 6 of these people in the room, and halfway through this 2-day movie reference, like 4 words, and I didn't even realize I said it until the guy from Ireland responded back with the proper response. And I went, that was just frightening but cool.
Yeah, that's the other thing too, like this that's the other thing I never expected this whole time I was writing the book, that I wasn't even sure I could get published in the United States. Like, it's been like bought and translated into like 20 other languages and published in 20 other countries already.
Wow.
And like, I got to go over to Finland and Norway and Italy and do book tours over there and like tour with translators who would, it was hysterical. Like, I would be hear them, repeat what I said with all these Italian words, like interspersed with words like Atari and Pac-Man. And,
so sales have been good.
Yeah.
I remember back in high school, I remember somebody, I was a teacher or something, gave me the concept that, there's some areas of the world where they're just now getting songs that we had 6 months ago. So there's somebody reading your book going, well, War Games is playing at the theater down the street.
Yeah.
It's brand new.
A couple of people joke with me about that. They're like, dude, you totally give away the ending of War Games. I'm like, it's from 1984. If you haven't seen it yet.
Statute of limitation on spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler alert. Yeah. Once the movie is, older than people who are driving, I'm allowed to give away.
Yeah, there's your Back to the Future reference. But it's brand new.
Yeah.
Spoiler alert, Jesus dies. Is it too soon?
Yeah. Exactly.
So have you always been a writer, like mucking around with it, or you just decided to dive in?
It was always what I was best at. It was always what I was, seemed to have the most aptitude. I was not good at math and not that interested in science. I didn't get interested in science until later. But in school, like, I was, my short stories, it was always the English and creative writing were always what I got the best grades in and always, what I was drawn to. But I just never, I never assumed I could make a living at it because making a living as a writer is really hard. So I was also always interested in computers and entering the workforce in the 90s. That was handy because that was, kind of when the computer industry and the internet and all of that took off. And I was able to make a living just helping people with computers and, and doing web design and technical writing and things like that. And I would always started out interested in movies and wanted to make movies and started out writing screenplays. And that led to me writing Fanboys, which was like the first thing that I ever real screenplay that I ever wrote and got produced. And that made me believe, I made a little bit of money from that and I was able to quit my day job and start working, writing full time just to see if I could make a go of it. And I ended up selling another screenplay that I wrote that didn't get made, but I made enough money off of it to keep writing and not work a day job. And eventually,
what a shame.
Which was, a good thing because I was never that happy working at day jobs. And writing was always what I would try to do in the evenings on the weekends, but working with computers, it made it hard to sit in front of a computer all day and then go home at night and try to get back up in front of a computer and write or do it on the weekends on my time off. So it was slow going, but yeah, once Fanboys was kind of the turning point for me, and then I, you know, made enough money from that to write a little bit longer and then sold the next thing, and that was when I, you know, I decided to stop writing screenplays just because my experience with Hollywood had been, you know, not ideal, and it seemed like a really rough business. And I also, you know, just screenwriters end up being really frustrated people because what you write, no one ever reads it, and ends up getting changed really drastically in the process of getting made, or it never gets made at all.
Right.
Like, those are the things. So that made me want to try to tell a story with nothing between me and the audience, just to see if just to see what would happen, just to see if I could geek out directly to the reader with nobody telling me how to geek out, and just see what happens. And that was very
like this.
Yes, this is how, you know, this is how I want to do it, you know, and that was a good move, man. That changed my whole life writing this book. Well, and it,
well, let me skip ahead. I had another question, but I'm gonna skip ahead here for a second. Now, you know, I saw where Warner Brothers jumped on your book right after it came out. So
yeah.
I thought one of the stipulations was that you were going to be attached to the screenplay.
Yeah, it was. They had to let me write the first draft of the screenplay.
Oh, okay, the first draft. I got you.
Yeah, which, you know, any movie that Warner Brothers makes always ends up having multiple writers work on it. Even if one writer gets credited, there are always multiple cooks in the kitchen.
Yeah,
that's just the way. That's just the way big Hollywood movies get, because different writers have different strengths, and they want, you know, and the director always wants to, you know, have a hand in the creative process, and it's much harder. But yeah, that was the part of the deal with getting the film rights, is if you wanted to buy the film rights to my book, you had to let me write the first draft of the screenplay, just so I could kind of influence the direction that the adaptation would take. So that's
what
I did.
Yeah, what a deal. We're just going to rewrite it anyway.
yeah, which is what ends up happening. But, you know, at least I will, you know, I got to have a hand in it and say my piece and explain to them at the studio what was important to me. And you know, and also, you know, eventually, and now it's still in the early stages of development and there hasn't been a director hired yet. But when there is a director hired, I would hope that he'll read the book and then I'll be able to have a conversation with him. And then that's when I'll start to get a sense of how faithful to the book the movie will be. But it's Warner Brothers, and they made all the Harry Potter movies, which I felt like are really faithful to the source material, as faithful as you could be while still making it cinematic. But but that's also J.K. Rowling, and she's one of the most successful novelists ever, and I'm not, you know, this is my first book, so it's a whole different, it's kind of a different thing. But I, you know, they seem really invested in making it, and they spent a lot of money on it to get the rights and to develop the script. So I have high hopes that you know, that it'll end up being a movie, and that and the book has such a, you know, a growing fan base now, and it's become a New York Times bestseller in hardcover and in paperback, and it's selling really well in other countries, and they want to, you know, sell their movies around the world as well. So I'm hoping that that will result in it being really faithful to the source material, because they don't want to alienate the existing fan base. Just like Hunger Games, I felt like was really faithful because they knew there was a lot of people who love that book and we'd be pissed off if they changed it too much. So so I'm hoping that happens. And this other movie, Wreck-It Ralph, that's coming out this weekend, which is all about video game nostalgia and kind of mashes up all different video game characters from different companies together. That gives me hope that when the Ready Player One movie happens, we'll be able to get, you know, that kind of access to all the different pop culture stuff. People will see that it's an homage to all of that and a celebration of all of it and free advertising for their stuff. And so hopefully the movie will end up, you know, being as close to the book as they can make it.
I heard Michael Bay's attached to develop, direct.
Ernie, we will direct your movie.
Yeah, Disney just called.
Yeah. Right, you know, right on. Yeah.
I was kidding. I said, I heard Michael Bay was supposed to direct that movie. No.
Michael Bay? No. he's, you know, Michael Bay is good at what he does. Yeah. Well, he's good at making giant robots fight.
And things blow up. Yep.
And things blow up. So, but I just
want to. So for your final scene, yeah, we got you covered.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't get a good reaction with that Ninja Turtle thing.
No. They're still going to make it, though, I'm sure. But, But yeah, I just want somebody to direct it who ends up being a fan of the book. And there are, you know, there are a lot of people in the entertainment industry who've reached out to me who, you know, like are fans of the book and have, you know, said they want to be involved in the movie in some way. And I, you know, hopefully just the right director who gets it and wants to, you know, protect the vision of the book will get the job, but it's still up in the air. So well,
Craig and I will be extras. We'll die early if you want.
Yeah. Well, I have to fight to get myself as an extra in the movie. So.
Cameo appearance like Stan Lee.
Get in line behind Ernie.
Yeah, that's what I want. So we'll see. We'll see how it goes.
Well, now, Craig, you read the book, but I listened to the book of Audible by Will Wheaton. I assume Ernie, you've listened to Will do your work.
Yeah, that was awesome. My first time I got to hear the audiobook was when I picked Will to do it because he's like one of my favorite actors, and he's perfect
for that role.
He's totally perfect. He's like 2 months away from me in age, and he grew up loving all the same stuff that I did, and he knew how to pronounce everything perfectly and and even do the right video game sounds, and he totally, you know, he's part of my audience and the perfect guy to do it. So I always knew I wanted him to do it, and luckily he was familiar with my work from, you know, he'd
dude,
run across
Percival looks like.
Yeah, well, I don't know if he looks. No. I don't think he looks like Parzival, but he did a great job doing his voice. And he just came to Austin Comic Con last weekend, and we got to hang out again. But
is that where the picture of you and him sitting on the hood of the DeLorean is from?
Yeah, he came. He was there.
That's awesome.
Yeah, he was, and that was my DeLorean that I first listened to the Ready Player One audiobook in. I left in my book tour in my DeLorean that I had bought for the book tour, and then as I'm driving in my DeLorean with my flex capacitor, and then I put in my audiobook of my super nerdy novel with Will Wheaton reading it. I'm like, this is the geekiest moment in human history.
I'm surprised I didn't find you dead in the driver's seat.
Yeah, I know, of a brain.
So you must have had that moment after you talked to Steve Rickenberg when he says, what's the geekiest moment in your life?
Yeah, that was definitely maybe not just my
yet.
Not just my life, just anybody's life. It was
pretty up there, dude.
Yeah, but yeah, he's just the nicest guy and the perfect guy to do it, and just his fan base, everybody who would dig Will and would want to read an audiobook read by Will is like the exact person that I would, you know, because he is like the spokesperson, you know, for
he's
geeks.
The vice president, for crying out loud.
Yeah, exactly.
did you write him in first and then pick him as a reader, or how did that work?
Yeah, no, I put that in because I, you know, used to do spoken word performance and poetry slam stuff here in Austin, Texas, and I would record MP3s of these geeky monologues that I would do about being a geek and growing up in the 80s, and I put them on my website, and people would pass them around, and they would become like internet memes. And Will found my website one day, and then he linked to it on FARC, which is like used to be as like popular as Reddit, and and that resulted in like a, you know, just a ton of people coming to my website and getting into my stuff. And so just because and at first I didn't realize who had done it till I went to FARC and like read the comments and saw that it was Will Wheaton, and I like nearly crapped my pants. Holy crap, Wesley Crusher like gave me a shout out on FARC.
I like it when you put it that way.
Yeah,
Wesley Crusher gave me a shout out on FARC.
Yeah, so I emailed him and said thank you and you know how flattered I was, and he was really encouraging and just the sweetest guy, and that's how he remembered me. So, you know, and so years later when I was writing the book, I was writing that scene. I'm like, oh, you know, I'll make, and I'm also a big fan of Cory Doctorow. And I'm like, I'll make Cory and Will the president and vice president of the Oasis, because they're both into internet freedom and internet, you know, and big internet celebrities. And it just seemed perfect. And a way for, and Cory did the same thing. He linked to my spoken word stuff on Boing Boing and resulted in a, you know, a ton of people coming to my website. And I'm like, oh, this would be the great way for me to repay both of them is by, you know, giving them a shout out. So I did that and then forgot about it. And then once I Will agreed to do the audiobook, I'm like, oh, he's going to, you know, discover that he's a character.
Run across
book.
It.
Yeah. But he doesn't read the book in advance because it helps his performance. If he's reading it for the first time, he just reads it as he goes along. So he didn't discover that he was a character until that day. That he read, you know, read his own name, but he played it straight. He told me he like, did that throw you? And he's like, no, I read it like a boss. He did. He read the whole book like a boss. So I
would have gone, what the?
Yeah.
Whoa, back up. That's awesome.
So I was really lucky with him and with just the other novelists that read it and gave me a blurb, like Patrick Rothfuss and John Scalzi, guys that I really admire, like read the book and dug it and got it and gave me awesome, you know, like blurbs for the cover.
Speaking of John Scalzi, have you read Red Shirts?
Oh, yeah. I listened to, on my paperback book tour, I listened to Will read Red Shirts because Will reads a lot of John Scalzi's audiobooks, which is one of the reasons I wanted to pick him, because I had heard him read some of John's works and knew he was awesome at it. And yeah, so when I was on my paperback tour driving all the way up the and down the West Coast earlier this summer, I listened to Will read Red Shirts, and it was amazing. And hysterical just to have you know, a Star Trek novel read by Will, and he's, you know, he gets it, like he's the guy. John and I both want Will to read every audiobook that we ever do. He's the man.
I just want him to come to the house and hire him so he can just read to me, period.
Phone answering machine message.
That might be expensive.
Speaking of your blog, why does your blog banner image have like a bazillion different versions of Ready Player One?
Those are all the foreign editions of my book.
Whenever
they publish my book in like a different country, they send me like a new version with a new cover, and I have them all lined up on my bookshelf. And it's every time I look at it, I just can't believe that.
That's cool.
You know, my book is in, you know, Italian and German and, you know, Finnish and Chinese, and it's just crazy.
Craig, I don't think ours made it past English.
No.
Well, yeah, it's just the weirdest thing, you know, especially for a book that seems so American and so rooted in American pop culture. But that's the thing, like when I found out when I went over to these other countries that they have all the same TV shows that we did, you know, like they grew up watching Knight Rider and Back to the Future 2. And so they get all the references just like we do. And a lot of them also had to speak English if they wanted to enjoy our video games and our pop culture. So yeah, it was not, it's not a big, you know, cultural divide at all between us and those other countries. Right. And next year it's going to come out in Japan, which has me really excited because there's, you know, so much Japanese pop culture in it. And I think they're going to dig it in Japan. I hope they do anyway.
You know who that was? Clint Eastwood.
There you go. There it is.
Are you ready for an 80s trivia quiz?
I am. I'm going to have to roll here in like 10 minutes. So,
all right, we'll make this quick then because it's all just quick answers. Craig, you start.
Okay. Some of these are easier. Some of them are tougher. So
I'll be the judge of that.
All right. Who was the lead singer of Genesis before Phil Collins?
Peter Gabriel.
Bingo.
Who turned down both the lead role in Back to the Future as well as the opportunity to perform the hit song Danger Zone in the movie Top Gun?
Oh, my God. I know Eric Stoltz played Marty McFly originally and then got fired, but I don't know who...
He's not a singer, I don't think.
No. So I don't know. I don't know that one.
Corey Hart.
Corey Hart, really?
That's what I said.
They offered him the role of Marty in Back to the Future?
He said
he had the sunglasses.
It says he turned it down.
I don't think that's correct, my friend.
I might have to go look for that one because that was I thought that one was kind of specific.
It's on the internet. It must be true.
The internet is full of lies, sir. Yeah. I know for a fact that they wanted. I've seen on the Back to the Future Blu-ray extras because I'm the kind of Back to the Future fan who watches all of those. Mm-hmm. That they said that they always wanted Michael J. Fox, but he was doing Family Ties and he was too busy, and so they had to go with their second choice, which was Eric Stoltz. And then once they started, they filmed like for a month with Eric Stoltz and shot a bunch of it, and it just wasn't working because he wasn't comfortable doing that kind of comedy. So then they went back and they said, this isn't working. We need Michael J. Fox because he's going to be perfect. And so they ended up getting him to do it while he was also filming Family Ties. So he would shoot Family Ties all day and then come home. And so I'm going to go ahead and call BS on that.
I got to throw this in there. That sounds
all right. Well, I appreciate that, but you have to know that I'm going to parse out your questions. And let's continue.
Okay. So what was the first word uttered by Ally Sheedy in Breakfast Club?
First word. Ha.
Nope.
Yes, she says, ha! She doesn't say anything in the whole movie, and then Emilio Estevez is talking, and then she says, ha! It's the first... What do you think that it is?
Vodka.
Vodka? Oh, vodka... it might be the first full word, but she says ha.
Oh, now we're splitting hairs.
She says the first vocalization in the movie is ha. And I
yeah, that's an onomatopoeia. Yeah.
All right. But I think "hi" is a word. You can play it in Scrabble. So I'm going to go ahead and say that your answer is incorrect, and my answer. This two questions in a row.
All right, I'll let you have. All right, and you're starting to show me up here.
Who was on the shirt that Mouth was wearing on the Goonies?
Oh man. I should know that. Isn't Mouth on it himself? Does he have a... No, that's a different movie where this guy has a shirt with his face on.
It should be more like, what was on the shirt? On his shirt.
What was on the shirt? I don't know. I can't think of it.
It's a cover of Prince's Purple Rain.
Oh, well, right on. See, you got me there. I will concede that one, gentlemen.
Okay. Well, good. Okay, score one for us, Chuck.
Right. Although you guys should be cross points for having incorrect answers.
We've got the answers here and we're still losing.
Right. Yeah. All right. What was Alf's girlfriend's name for Milmac?
Oh, I was never an Alf fan, so I couldn't tell you.
I just saw that show on the air like two nights ago. Shocked me.
It was Rhonda.
Rhonda? Oh, yeah. All right. Once again, I concede. Not an Alf watcher.
Okay.
Miami Vice question.
All right.
Sonny Crockett's real first name.
I have the internet right here. I could look it up, but I'm not going to. I don't know.
James
Crockett. Yeah, I would go with Sonny too. Sonny sounds cooler. You know, I was more of a Knight Rider, Airwolf, Street Hawk guy.
I'm with you there.
Their vehicle didn't, you know, have an AI computer in it or do anything awesome. So I was not.
Guns and half beer.
Right. And heroin and yeah, but still a good show. I do not begrudge Miami Vice fans, but that was never one of my shows.
Okay, I know you know. What was E.T.'s favorite candy?
Reese's Pieces. But do you know? Let me ask you a question, sir.
Okay.
Do you know what they originally wanted that candy to be, but the candy maker turned them down?
M&M's.
Right. See, there you go.
Yeah.
You guys got chops.
I'm also about 8 years older than you.
Right. Somebody at the Mars company, I'm sure, got fired for that. Once E.T. became the biggest movie of all time.
I think that's when Corey Hart was actually heading up Mars.
Right, yeah.
No, we're going to forget that. No.
Corey Hart, he was all over in the 80s.
According to G.I. Joe, which is a great way to start a sentence.
Half the battle. I'm going to go ahead and answer this question before you even ask it.
Yeah. What is half the battle?
Knowing is half the battle.
Yeah, that's right.
There you go.
Yeah.
And let's see. I know...
You could ask that one, aren't you?
What's that?
The next question.
No, I don't want to ask the next one. You
do it. Do it. I dare you. I triple dog dare you.
Okay, fine. Name all five of the new kids on the block.
Yeah, I would be ashamed of myself if I could do that.
I was ashamed for asking it.
There's no room in my brain that contains New Kids on the Block knowledge.
Okay, we'll go back to the easy one. We'll skip over the answer. It's not even worthy of an answer. Who played Sarah Connor in 1984's Terminator?
Linda Hamilton.
Ding, ding, ding.
All right, and since you're such a Back to the Future fan here, the Twin Pines Mall was named after the farm who owned it. Who owned
it? Old Man Peabody.
Right.
And what was his son's name?
What was his son's name?
He mentions it. He says it once.
What was his father's?
And as soon as you hear it, oh, nice tip of the hat, gentlemen.
What was it, Junior? I don't know.
Sherman
Potter.
Peabody.
Peabody Sherman.
Sherman Peabody. Okay.
Peabody. Yeah. Right. His boy named Sherman.
Okay, I get it.
All right. Okay. And who's playing the World Series in 2015?
The Cubbies.
And.
Miami.
Ding, 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 ding. Oh, nice one.
That might be the only sports trivia that I know. Yeah. This fictional Back to the Future sports
trivia. Hey, we got 3 years to go.
Well, Chuck, he's got the almanac, I'm sure. He's got the DeLorean.
I saw that too. In the picture, yeah.
Yeah, I got all that. I got all that crap in my DeLorean.
All that crap.
That's how he's getting so rich.
I wouldn't go that far.
All right, we know you got to cut out of here, and it has been a lot of fun, Ernie, and appreciate you giving us your time.
Right on. Thanks, guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks. Yeah, take care.
All right, bye, guys.
Bye.
All right, thank you, Ernie.
Once again, we want to thank Ernie Cline for his time. We had a great time and hope you've had a fun time listening also.
If you like the show, there are many ways to show your love. You can call the listener line at 206-222-2428. That's 222-CHAT to help you remember it easy. As if you haven't, you know, long-time listener, we could listen to you again. Technorama at chuckchat.com is the email address. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook. And hey, go to that Facebook page and like us over there. We're not too proud.
You can like us anywhere, but especially there.
You can like us on a Monday. Anyway, special thanks to Matt Marr for providing great blog content during the week. Everyone who sent us links. Don't send us your logs, please.
Send us
links to the regular show during the week. We love reviewing those, and we will do our best to get them in the show. There's just so much Technorama news out there. Sometimes we can't get it all in. Otherwise, we'd have a four-hour show, and no one would listen to that. Well, no one listens to this anyway, so let's move on.
Yeah.
Thanks for those who download and listen to this show faithfully. We really appreciate you and your time and the time you give us. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with all the great shows over at farpointmedia.com. Go over there, check them out. We know you're going to find something you love. If you're listening to this show the old-fashioned way, you know there is a more modern way than just clicking on the link on the website. You can have it delivered to you automatically for free. Just go to iTunes and look for Technorama. I believe we're still the only Technorama on iTunes. But yeah. They'd look for the one with our...
Yeah, hurry up while we're easy to find.
And until next time, tell a friend about Technorama and give me a binary high five.
Oh, 101.